if you're innovating, creating, or making a difference.
This show is for you. Welcome to Over Coffee. I'm Dot Cannon. Here on Over Coffee, we talk with artists and innovators about the process of changing the world
in terms of what they do.
I want to do two colors. And George said, you can't do that. But I developed a method with Elise. And at the end of my tour there, George didn't come over and say, well, congratulations, Walter, on doing something we've never done before.
Multiple award-winning artist Walter Askin continues to challenge himself after more than six decades as a creative professional. Walter has exhibited his work all over the world and is known for colorful and imaginative paintings, graphics, and sculpture. His most recent work is currently on display as part of the Los Angeles County Arboretum's exhibit, which is entitled The Nature of Sculpture. His piece is called The Sentinel. Walter, what do you remember very best about growing up in Pasadena that led to your becoming the artist you are today?
Well, I think one thing that helped a lot was the visibility of art available so that if I wanted to see actual pieces of art, I could always find them at the Pasadena Art Museum. And the schools also did feature artwork. People were encouraged to do art as a part of the program.
What was one of your own favorite experiences creating your art then?
Oh, probably the most fun was the Pasadena Art Festival. And that was on the esplanade that leads out from the City Hall. And there were lots of booths by a number of different artists. And I was in high school, and I went down and signed up for a booth. And they accepted that idea, and so I hung my work up. And my pal Wally Hedrick saw that I had a booth, and he went and got a booth too. And he hung a clothing line and hung his works up with clothespins, which was rather unique and pretty funky and bohemian as a thing to do. But I worked on one of the structures that they had with butcher tape over a support. And that was fun because you could meet a lot of people. So the next year I went down and I signed up for the largest space they had. And I asked all my friends, almost all of whom stayed up in San Francisco once they went there. They went to the Art Institute, I went to Berkeley. And they only got angry when they put it in the paper as Walter Askin and his modern group. But it was a lot of fun. And then we were all able to enter the San Gabriel Valley show, which was a show of artists from Pasadena clear out to Claremont. And we all got in. And so it was quite amazing, actually, for them to have us young squirts in the museum with our works visible. And so by the time we went to San Francisco, we were all used to exhibiting. We expected to be seen. And so we all made quite a splash in San Francisco. And the San Francisco Museum of Art used to have about three shows a year, one in drawing, one in sculpture, and one in painting. And we were in those shows. And Mrs. Miller from the Museum of Modern Art came through, and she picked some of the artists so that, like I mentioned Wally before, he married a friend of mine from Berkeley, Jay DeFeo, who's now achieving quite a lot of attention, but she's long gone from us because she worked on a painting that lasted 8 years. And when you finish an 8-year painting, what do you do after that? So you drink a lot. She also smoked a lot too. So she didn't last a long time, but she and the rest all did important work there. And Wally and Jay were in the first show that Mrs. Miller did of 16 Young Americans. So they had their works there. And they had works by a couple of unknown people like Jasper Johns and Robert Rauschenberg. So it was quite a big event. They were sent tickets because they didn't have much money. and they didn't go to the opening. They sold their tickets because they needed the money more than they needed the attention. And they weren't, none of us grubbers at the trough of the museum. We did what we believed in doing. And that was, I think, a unique thing that happens when you start young. You start on a path before people have a whole lot of chance to get their hooks into you and what you're about.
And that must have been an incredible gift for a young artist in the 1960s.
Well, it was, and it doesn't exist today. And that festival is no longer there, and the San Gabriel Valley show is no longer there. And the one-person shows that were at the museum every month are no longer there. The last two items were Walter Hopp's fault. He did a great thing in having the Duchamp show and in promoting artists from the Ferris Gallery, but there are some things that he obviated which I would find very desirable today. If you look around the show and you start to ask artists, who else do you know in the show? They won't know a lot of the other artists. That's because the San Gabriel Valley show gave everybody a chance to see everything that was going on every year in this entire area. And that created a kind of fraternity of artists. And with the one-person shows at the museum, everybody showed up every month, got to see each other, got to evaluate what another person was doing in depth. And it meant a lot to all of us because it gave us a kind of exposure that isn't available to young artists today. So a lot of people do esoteric things or things that are meant as entertainment rather than as something of an aesthetic nature. They're just trying to get attention. They're saying, look at me, look at me. And it's easily understood because there is a need in the visual arts to be seen. You know, that's the nature of the beast.
I would like to get your thoughts on what a young artist really ought to do today. But before that, I'd love to have you tell me a little bit about your piece that we just saw here in this particular show.
Oh, The Sentinel? Yes. Well, we came out and we selected a spot because a sentinel is a person who's looking out, somewhat like a guardian. And we picked an area with a mound so it could be high up. And also, if you look at the plants in the area, they're vertical in their nature too. They're not shrubs that are going horizontally, but they're desert-type plants that go up. And Elise and I, my wife, are very familiar with the desert. And so we experienced that a lot, and it seemed like a very compatible kind of arrangement where there's not a lot crowding in on the piece itself.
What was the experience like for you creating The Sentinel? How long a time, and in what ways did it surprise you, if at all, as an artist?
Well, people asked you how long, and that's not an important question. The question really is, what were you after and what were you trying to achieve with that work? It doesn't matter how long it takes. It could take 8 years or 10 years or be done in 3 minutes. And people worry about that, particularly when they go out to buy works. How long did this take you? And that doesn't concern me because I'll have work sitting around the studio and I'll work on this one for a while and I'll move on to something else. And I try to do works in clusters of three or four, so you get a much clearer idea of what you're up to when you move from one work to another via that system. So you have this experience of this one, and you say, oh, that one doesn't have that. And so it makes you amplify your work quite a bit as a result of that. And it means you could also radically work over works if people will let you do that.
What about the question that you would like to have been asked about what you wanted to achieve with Sentinel, and did you achieve it?
Oh, that's, you asked that. I shouldn't have even mentioned anything because that's the hardest question of all to answer. But I'm interested in confluences, the convergence of two ideas or two people or two objects. So if you look at my work, you'll see it's not just one thing in isolation, but there are two different ideas. If you look at that figure, first of all, you see a head that's easily recognizable. But when you start to look at the torso, it's built in a different kind of form entirely. And that comes out from a quite different experience. I used to do a lot of work for the College Board, which meant flying back to New York 5 or 6 times a year. And flights can be boring, but they can also be productive. So you've got nothing else to do, so I would take letters in the alphabet and see how many variations I could make of those, not in terms of a person who designs type, but in terms of different forms, which should have different resonances. So different forms will have different qualities about them. And so I put those kinds of forms together with this other realistic forms. And then you notice it's sitting among greenery. So it's not isolated. The sculpture is one thing, the plants around it are something else. And they're all part of a piece. So that sculpture, unlike a lot of painting, where the relationships are internal, relates to things external to it, outside of it.
When you said different forms that have different kind of resonances, when you're talking about your letters of the alphabet exercise, what do you mean by that?
Well, if you're jumping out of an airplane in a parachute, you know what kind of shapes you'd like to land on. You'd like soft, round ones rather than sharp, pointy ones. So there's certain qualities in those sections. If you start to look at the forms, there's a certain level of repetition. But also, I always like to control that. With students, they will sometimes take one form and repeat it endlessly. And that was pretty prevalent during the Abstract Expressionist period in which I grew up. But the whole idea is to think as you're doing something. So you don't take the yellow here and do the same yellow over there or the same yellow up there. You start to alter those so that each one fits into that particular context perfectly. And the same is true of the shapes. So you have a little conflict or a little energy that comes from one thing playing off against another. So there's some people who like solos in music. You know, one instrument, that's not what I'm for. I'm more for a full orchestra where you bring in as much as you can have, or as much as the work will bear, actually, because you can't put it all in one piece, but you do have to extend the range of the piece, you know, the range of elements that are involved in the piece.
You've already given me some great lessons on creativity just by talking about Sentinel, but how would you expand on that? Using your experience with Sentinel, please give the listener and me a little mini lesson in creativity if you're starting a major project.
Well, that work didn't start by itself. I was doing totemic forms and seeing how these different forms stacked up one against the other. And it was a work that needed to be done in sculpture. And so I got a residency for 2 months at the Kohler Company in Sheboygan, Wisconsin. So you drive there, you put up an artist house, they give you the safety equipment, and you go into the factory and work there with the workmen who are working in cast iron and enameling. Now 99.9% of the artists work on the ceramic side. And in Kohler, that's easy because the slip goes through pipes in the ceiling because they're pouring molds for toilets and sinks and things of that nature. So that I was the first person to get results on the cast iron side. Others had tried, but their tries were fairly futile for 2 reasons. One, they didn't have much preparation in terms of what they wanted to accomplish. I mean, they were just pouring things in the ground in the factory, and the workmen were not interested in that, or it didn't excite them, and they couldn't see the seriousness that needed to be put into the piece. And so I was able to really work with these people And we were doing great big Pepsat things that were 10 feet long and 3 feet wide. And it was very, very hard work and very dangerous work too. Because as you're working, big cauldrons of molten cast iron are going by you. And so I asked, well, where does the artist work? Right over there, right in the middle of all of this thing with the big furnaces going and shooting off molten metal and that sort of thing. So you had to be very careful. And then those pieces are taken to the carbide room, where a man in a full outfit goes in and shoots carbide pellets at the piece to clean it up. And then that goes to a place where they put a ground on it. And then it goes over to the enamel works. So when I went over to the enamel works, I talked with a man who's in charge of enameling, a fellow named George Werwein. And everybody, because there are 50 vibrating sieves going on all the time, they're all deaf. So discourse between them is very difficult, even though every post in the building has earplugs on it and face masks and so forth. These men in Wisconsin didn't use those at all. I think they regarded it as unmanly to do that. So I went up into the room where I mixed up the colors I was going to use, and I asked if there are any toxics in this material. And they said, don't worry about it. And so the next day, a nurse came in, and she took blood from all of them, but none from me. And I said, what is that for? She said, well, we test everybody for lead poisoning, and when the lead level gets up to a certain height, we move them to another part of the factory. So after that, I was extremely careful and washed my hands, got out of there whenever they were blowing off, because they blow off the hoods on the furnaces at the end of every shift or whenever they're changing colors. So the best thing that Elise and I found was just to get out of that factory for that period of time. Once the colors were selected, they're put into a sort of low crucible, a little flat pan piece that sits there by the furnace. Now this furnace is at, I think, 7,500 degrees. And so you take the cast iron piece that you've done that's covered with this ground, and you put it into that furnace. So you're standing about 25 feet away, and you use a small rail line with a little train on it to push these things in and set them in the furnace, press a button, the furnace closes, and when it's red hot, you then go in and lift it up, pull it out, and take a vibrating sieve and run it back and forth across the piece until it will no longer accept the enamel. It's turning into glass as you watch. And you do that 3 times for every color. And with George Werwein, I wanted to do 2 colors. And George said, you can't do that. He was the kind of guy who'd say, Merry Christmas. He was a very ferocious kind of person. But I developed a method with Elise for doing that. And so we did secondary firing, which I'd never done before. And at the end of my tour there, George didn't come over and say, well, congratulations, Walter, on doing something we've never done before. I was happy that we were able to achieve what we did.
In addition to one-person exhibitions in Vienna, New York, and San Francisco, Walter's professional experience has included serving as president of the Los Angeles Printmaking Society. He also taught college-level art classes for more than 40 years and received an Outstanding Professor Award from Cal State Los Angeles. While he retired from teaching in 1992, he still has some thoughts about how current art students can get their voices heard.
If you're going to teach people about art, you've got to be doing it yourself. And so you've got to have that, not only a conceptual sense or a technological sense, but you have to have a feeling sense about the materials that you're employing to realize your vision. And that is essential. The thing is, it's got to be as close to the studio practice as possible. It can't be divorced from what you're going to actually be doing later on. And so much of teaching is devoted by some teachers to exercises, which you're going to use later on, of course. But in fact, it takes a sense of the whole process, not just putting that off. You have to start with the whole, and then you've got to use your own mind. So the students have to have a chance to instigate their own work. And a lot of students come in, they don't have any idea about things. So I always used to show slides every class, because you have to start looking at art to see what the possibilities are and to have a range of ideas in your head before you start. And then you've got to be receptive to ideas as they develop in the work. So you've got to take a chance on doing something where you don't know if it's going to work out or how it's going to be. You've got to expose yourself to the chance of failure, of falling flat. Well, if you're in high school, for instance, and the same is true in college, you know, people don't want to be seen as doing bad things. And so they tend to recreate their mastery, as they put it. Well, it's too soon in high school, I think, for most people, not all, but most people, to have a mastery, because that limits them on what they can do, because things are always changing in the art world. You can't master one thing and have that be perfect and just go on doing that forever. Also, you don't want to talk about the same thing all the time. Sometimes you're talking to one type of audience, or you're trying to express one sort of idea, and other times you are working on something quite different. And you've got to be able to develop those different things. For instance, I never had really any training in sculpture, but I've done quite a bit of sculpture. What I did have was a very programmatic series of exercises, because sculpture at Berkeley at that time was in the architecture department. So it was thought of as a kind of separate sort of thing. So you've got to have people tanked up with ideas, and then they've got to take a chance on things, and they've got to be willing to just really make a mess. And sometimes you'll find that people are doing their great work underneath the work that they want you to see. And so I always find those things and put them up on the wall so that they see that that was their natural inclination. And that's the thing that they really are interested in working on, not this thing over here that they saw the guy next to him work on, or somebody at a slide working on. You've got to be prepared to fail.
You and I have been listening to award-winning modern artist and author Walter Askin. You can see Walter's latest sculpture, The Sentinel, in the Los Angeles County Arboretum's current outdoor exhibit, The Nature of Sculpture, which features the work of 80 local artists. The Nature of Sculpture's dates have been extended. It was originally scheduled to close in early August, but will now be open through October 15th. Meanwhile, if you happen to be in Pasadena, check the local bookstores for Walter's latest book, True Fictions, which is a gently satirical look at the art world. That's True Fictions by Walter Askin. And that concludes this edition of Over Coffee. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to hear more Over Coffee podcasts, our link is twomaverix.com. That's twomaverix.com. And you can contact us at twomaverix@gmail.com. The music you're hearing is royalty-free production music provided by Pond5 at pond5.com. I'm Dot Cannon. Here's wishing you a cappuccino day.